listening to a shortcast from the London School of Economics and Political Science, Shaping the Post-COVID World series, a digested version of our live online public event series. This event was recorded on 19th October 2020. A full version is available to download via the LSE website or from your usual podcast provider.
Welcome to the LSE for this online event about data-driven responses to COVID-19 opportunities and limitations. My name is Susan Scott. I'm a professor in information systems in the Department of Management at the LSE. The panel's going to continue the conversation that we began at our last event in May, reviewing the opportunities and limitations from a societal, legal, and technical perspective and highlighting the risks of exclusion and discrimination that can arise. Now I'm delighted to hand over to Dr. Edgar Whitley, Associate Professor in the Information Systems and Innovation Group in the Department of Management. Edgar, over to you.
Beginning of October, the government reported a blip, as it were, in the figures, where over 12,000 new infections had to be reported on one day. This was simply the result of a large number of test results not being fed properly into the dashboard and presumably equally into the processes for contact tracing, etc., etc. How could this happen? What were the issues? It seems from the press reports that this was a function of using Microsoft Excel, but in particular, a version of Excel that was updated in about 2005, 2006, 2007. So over 10-year-old technology. The idea, as has been described, is that the individual labs would share their data in essentially very basic raw data formats, because different labs may have different systems. Those would then be imported into Excel spreadsheets. And then those spreadsheets would then be sent to Public Health England for aggregation and further processing. The problem that arose was that the choice of format, the XLS, the early version of the Excel format, was limited to 65,000 rows in the spreadsheet, which if each case had a number of rows, apparently would be about 1,400 cases. So if a lab was reporting fewer than 1,400 cases, all of them would be imported in the spreadsheet. So they were being sent from the labs perfectly fine, but being imported, and that would work fine. If you had more than that many cases, essentially the software would just delete, ignore all of those rows that wouldn't fit at the bottom of the spreadsheet. And of course, if they're not imported into the spreadsheet, then they don't go into that further process of dashboards, which is useful for planning whether we need to introduce stricter measures. But importantly, apparently also not being fed to the contact tracers that say, these people have had positive test results, please now self-isolate, don't spread the disease further, et cetera, et cetera. And so we can have a number of responses, a number of reactions. From a straightforward health perspective, health of our community, health of our society, I think there was an awful lot of anger. How on earth could this happen that we have built processes that allow people to continue to spread the disease because they've been in contact with people who we know have reported positive? This also addresses this question of confidence in government. And there are real concerns about the long-term trust in government, already hit when the guidance was interpreted, shall we say, loosely by government advisors and members of parliament. But if the government, who we particularly rely on in times of crisis to be able to do things, then these questions of long-term trust become significant. And again, there's a kind of anger associated with that. But there's also a way of thinking about this in terms of what actually went on. And drawing on my colleague Leslie Wilcox's work on outsourcing and IT outsourcing, this raises important questions about this relationship between the tiny state and the privatized companies that are working with them. So an initial question was, who just designed this process? Who thought about the requirements? Why did that nobody think that there might be a limit to how many cases any one lab might be returning in any one day. Even if that had been built in as a requirement, that was a very, very strong assumption to make, particularly as everyone was expecting a rise in cases as we come into autumn and come into winter. So was there a proper testing requirement stage going on, or did people just not even think about that? Then there's the question of the constraints around the use of technology. Why were they using an old format for the Excel spreadsheets? Was this because Public Health England was running old PCs with old versions of Windows that wouldn't necessarily be able to run the latest versions of Excel spreadsheets? And if that was the case, then surely that could have been fixed fairly early on, because somebody who's been paid lots of money to support the state should have been aware of that particular constraint. Or did nobody think of it? And then there's also broader questions around data governance more generally as to how a process could be set up, whether it was within government or in this case between government and private sector support, for allowing this kind of activity to be undertaken. And we know that the government has got a data ethics framework. The updated version was issued in September 2020. It's a lot more specific. It's a very nice framework for thinking about data ethics kinds of questions, primarily from a kind of modeling and AI perspective, but many of the considerations actually apply as much for importing test results into a big dashboard and then taking actions arising from it.
And now over to Dr. Alison Powell from the LSE Department of Media and Communications. Alison, over to you.
I wanted to talk a little bit about how I think about the relationship between the huge ethical questions that are raised by the COVID-19 responses and the specific aspects that are sort of data driven. So what I want to just lay out very briefly in the next couple of minutes is this idea that there's a kind of underlying structure that is completely shot through with ethical questions, which are about what is the good in society and how are we meant to act well. And on top of that underlying structure that is sort of shot through with really difficult ethical questions about who do we value? What do we value? How systemically are we able to understand what's going on in our life? We have a data system that is both material and symbolic. So it is both a data system that produces material that is being stored and used to predict and maintain and structure our everyday lives. And it's also something that is communicating to us all the time. So these graphs that we are invited to interpret are potentially taken by people as sort of one source among many, which produces what people think of as a crisis of misinformation. And that's something that we need to sort of think about these things separately. So if we think about the idea of this mode of power that's being reinforced through this material and symbolic dynamic, we can see that in the UK anyway, that mode of power is a kind of tending towards a super privatized tiny state with a set of kind of citizens who are primarily consumers of either data or information about data. Or they're producers of data that allow the sort of super tiny privatized state and its actors like Palantir, who's running lots of dashboards that are filtering information, to more effectively make decisions. And this is a really difficult thing to identify and critique because it's so fundamental. It's that underlying sort of social order that produces all of these really tricky ethical questions. And when we look up from that to the top layer, we start seeing not only, oh, we have a super tiny privatized state that's outsourced quite a lot of the data management to Palantir, but also, oh, we have a media and communication system that's using data about the COVID-19 pandemic in ways that are really easy to put into conversation with the idea that everything is misinformation. For example, this morning, I went to look at a map of London and look at London's infection rates. And, you know, I've looked at two or three different maps, and I realized that some of the maps had completely different color codings for the infection rates than they did 2 weeks ago. suggesting perhaps that things really hadn't changed that much since August, when in fact the level of COVID-19 infections across the UK has gone up by a factor of, in some places, up to 1,000, in some places a factor of 500, in some places a factor of 2. But this was impossible to determine from the visualization. This introduces this question about the way that data plays as fact, which is something that sociologist Norcha Maris has talked about when she alerted us to the risks of computational systems in terms of how they embed the possibility of deception and manipulation into the foundation of the social world. And she wrote about this in terms of Volkswagen's cars being programmed to identify when they were likely to be in testing situations and then to perform differently. But what I'm curious about is whether we now have data systems that are so unstable in terms of their symbolic and material situation that they are amenable to being perceived as sources of misinformation, which makes it very difficult to challenge that underlying problem with the structure of society and to actually get at those deep ethical questions. And they are really about what is good. So is it to respect rights, to be fair, to be transparent, to be good value for money, to build capacity by keeping people healthier? Is the good to think about the systemic long-term safety and health of the entire environment? These are questions we can't even get to because we're trapped in a moment where everything that is factual and data-driven has been placed into question both materially and symbolically. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Alison. And Dr. Sita Gangadharan, Associate Professor in the LSE Department of Media Communications, over to you.
I've been thinking about over the last few weeks, if there will ever be a way of thinking about surveillance in affirmative or positive terms. When we're talking about the data-driven responses to COVID-19, we need to center our conversation and understanding about the ways in which surveillance is being normalized at alarming rates in this current pandemic. I'd like to also draw attention to the fact that, as Alison alluded to, we're not really only dealing with the health pandemic, we're also dealing with the pandemic of racism. And so I want to just really briefly think through three types of surveillance that I think are in operation in this current crisis, and then just speak briefly about how we potentially get around this increase in surveillance. Just as context, much of what I'm talking about really does pertain to both the United States and to a lesser extent, the United Kingdom and Europe. But there are three different kinds of surveillance that I think are really present in the current context. The first pertains to the idea of marginalizing surveillance and the fact that new technologies being deployed during this twin pandemic increase what Torin Monaghan calls marginalizing surveillance, or what Simone Brown refers to as racialized surveillance. Recently, Data for Black Lives, for example, produced a series of maps that are looking at racial disparities in the United States with respect to both deaths due to COVID-19, as well as number of cases. And in spite of this awareness and the many months that have now transpired, we're still seeing figures of great disparity. So I'll just point to the state of Vermont, for example, which recently was written up in Politico as an exemplar of a state in the United States that responded early and that instituted measures to really clamp down on social interactions. And in fact, the total number of cases of Black people in the state of Vermont is